Hello and good day. You are tuned into Warning Shots here on CKUW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKUW's independent international news show, and CKUW 95.9 FM is your listener-driven radio station on the FM dial in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Jonathan Wilson, filling in for Scott Price today. It is July 5th. On today's show, interviews on fast food worker strikes in the U.S., as well as China's plan to resettle indigenous nomads. All of that, and of course, your international news briefs. But first, here are a couple announcements. As I said at the top of the show, CKUW is a listener-driven media source. We take listener-driven very seriously. That means that not only are you supporting us by listening right now, but we also rely on your donations every February during Fund Drive. You can also get a hold of us at 774-6877 during the show. I would love to hear your questions, comments, and concerns. And you can also email the regular host, Scott Price, at warningshots.ckuw959@gmail.com. Also, follow Scott Price on Twitter at warningshots and follow CKW on Twitter at warningshots. Now, here is some of the news that is happening around the world right now. The Richmond Times Dispatch reports a senior judge was sworn in as Egypt's interim president Thursday to replace ousted president Mohamed Morsi as the military launched a major crackdown against the Muslim Brotherhood. Reeling from what it called a military coup against democracy, the Islamist group said it would not work with the new political system. The military is installing a new civilian leadership to pave the way to new elections, saying it will stay out of politics. The army says it did so in the name of millions of Egyptians who had taken to the streets, demanding Morsi be removed. In the eyes of protesters, Morsi and the Brotherhood, from which he hails, had warped the democratic process. Many say the group has proved its anti-democratic nature and argue that its leaders committed prosecutable crimes. An update from just recently, Egyptian troops have opened fire on mostly Islamist protesters marching on a Republican Guard headquarters in Cairo today to demand the restoration of the ousted President Mohamed Morsi. At least one, two, or three people have died, depending on which report you read. The shootings came as tens of thousands of supporters were chanting, "Down with military rule," rallied around the country. CBC reports Icelandic lawmakers introduced a proposal in Parliament on Thursday to grant immediate citizenship to National Security Agency leaker Edward Snowden, who admits to revealing key details of U.S. surveillance activities. Ögmundur Jonasson, whose liberal left-green party is backing the proposal, along with the Pirate Party and Brighter Future Party, put the issue before the Judicial Affairs Committee, but the idea received minimal support. Snowden is believed to be stuck in a Moscow airport transit area, seeking asylum from more than a dozen countries. At one point, he told the Guardian newspaper that he was inclined to seek asylum in a country that shared his values and that, quote, "the nation that most encompasses this is Iceland." But to apply for asylum in Iceland, Snowden would have to reach the nation's soil. Granting Snowden immediate citizenship would circumvent that issue. The same tactic helped get eccentric chess master Bobby Fischer to Iceland from Japan in 2005 to escape U.S. prosecution for breaking sanctions imposed on the former Yugoslavia. And the BBC reports at least 12 people have been killed and 5 wounded in a suicide attack at a police station in the southern Afghan province of Uruzgan, officials say. Most of the victims are thought to be police officers who were having lunch at the time of the attacker. The station in Tirin Kot is used by police guarding the road to Kandahar. A senior intelligence official told the BBC that the assailant had managed to gain entry to the dining hall because he was wearing a police uniform. It is not clear if the bomber was a member of the police force, but Mohammed Kapalwak said it was a clear breach of security that would be investigated. That is just some of the news that is happening around the world right now. Stay tuned to hear an interview on fast food worker strikes in America. This is Warning Shots on CKW 95.9 FM.
KW specializes in overnight radio with late nights programming and live DJs with shows such as Matt Baboon, Crystal Palace, Winnipeg Arena's On Fire, Metal Monday, The Lyrical Lounge, Trouble with the Sandman, and Radio Schizophrenia. CKW is your alternative on the late night dial, 95.9 FM, midnight is only the beginning.
Here. This is Warning Shots on CKUW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKUW's independent international news show. I'm your fill-in host today, Jonathan Wilson. We now turn to the United States. Over the last several months, fast food workers across the U.S. have gone out on strike demanding unionization, better working conditions, and wages. Scott Price, the normal host, talked with Martine Raffanen, who is an organizer for Jobs with Justice in St. Louis, Missouri.
My name is Martine Raffanen. I am a Lutheran minister in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm the co-chair of the Workers' Rights Board of Missouri Jobs with Justice, and I'm also the community director for STL 735, St. Louis Can't Survive on 735, which is our fast food worker movement in Missouri.
Explain sort of the organization and what kind of organizing you guys do and what the issues are there.
So the low-wage worker movement, as you know, many cities have experienced workers walking off the job or going on strike to demand higher wages and the right to form a union without retaliation. So a number of cities throughout the nation have experienced this type of 24-hour legal strike. St. Louis is one of those cities. We had strikes on May the 8th and 9th of this year. We had over 100 workers and 30 restaurants that where there was these were places where workers walked off the job demanding higher wages and the right to form a union without retaliation. They were strongly supported by community members who helped to walk them back to their jobs and who organized themselves to rapidly respond to any retaliation that was experienced by workers. So we believe that workers will continue to expand, build their power, grow in each of the areas where this is taking place. Hopefully it will expand to other places as well, where workers will continue to bring the message of the need for respect in the workplace, higher wages, wages that meet the basic necessities of their lives, and the opportunity to seek that through forming a union without retaliation.
Yeah. Now I'm curious in this kind of organizing that you do, because it seems like it's sort of uncharted territory for what unions usually do. I mean, usually you have like steel workers or something like that, right? Where Whereas this, it's a bit different because, I mean, the type of work and the type of situations these people are in. What kind of strategies or tactics did you have to develop in these organizing drives that were maybe different from the classic sort of union organizing?
Well, you're correct. It is notoriously difficult to organize in the fast food industry because the industry is kind of organized to keep workers from concerted action. So this is why we really have to work with the leadership of both workers and a coalition of community groups, faith groups, student groups, labor organizations, to stand alongside workers and bring the message of the need of these workers to a community and to our nation. Now, in the first step is always workers themselves taking the lead, telling the story, telling why they are engaged. These are workers, as you know, that are entirely vulnerable. They're not represented. And so any action that they take, they could face serious repercussions in their workplace. But they are taking courageous action because they believe that, as we say in St. Louis, STL 735, St. Louis can't survive on 735. It's not just these workers can't survive on 735. Our community can't survive on this type of low-wage job. There needs to be a way to make sure that workers can get a wage that actually pays for the basic necessities of their lives. And they believe that they can only get that done when they have the right to form a union without retaliation. So the first piece of this is that workers need to come together, organize, build power, increase their numbers, and then gain substantial community engagement and support so that they can take next steps in the organizing process.
Yeah, now in talking about the precarious nature of these workers, as I was reading about this, I mean, there's incidents where, workers have went out on strike, but then there was the danger of them when they came back into the workplace of being, basically hours being cut or being fired. And then so, and I guess it ties into what you were talking about before about the support of community members that in some cases, and I can't remember if this happened in St. Louis, but where it was community members, like you said, people in different church organizations would actually walk with the members that went on strike back into the stores, correct?
St. Louis was kind of highlighted as one of the communities that had developed really strong community support of workers. So what happened was that in St. Louis, there was an infrastructure already in place for kind of supporting low-wage workers. This was Missouri Jobs with Justice. So this is an organization that is a coalition of over 100 faith, community, student, and labor organizations. And it's an organization that has been fighting for increases in the minimum wage, moving toward a living wage, stopping payday loans, doing a lot of different things to support low-income, low-wage workers. And they've been doing this over the last decade. So this was kind of a natural process for this organization to step up and stand with workers. Once they found out that workers were going to be taking the lead and wanting to come together to tell their stories and to move this process forward, Jobs with Justice here in Missouri said, this is what we want to support, and we will do everything we can to stand alongside you and support you in this effort. So there is also in the state of Missouri two what we call workers' rights boards, one in Kansas City and one in St. Louis. So the workers' rights board certainly endorsed this campaign on the part of low-wage workers, and then immediately said, well, we are available to help you move this forward. What can we do? And one thing that community folks can do is they can actually stand by workers when they are going off the job or going on strike, and then actually walk them back to their job, which means that they go back with a worker, returning them to their job after a 24-hour legal strike, either economic or unfair labor practice strike, and they can, you know, essentially talk to management and say, you know, we are persons who know this worker. We feel strongly that they have the right to ask for a higher wage and to ask for the right to form a union without retaliation. We know that this person has been legally on strike for 24 hours. We're returning them back to work. We expect that there will be no retaliation. And if there is, we will hear from this worker and we'll come back to discuss this with you further. And so it's just a very strong message from the community. And in St. Louis, every worker was accompanied by 2 to 10 clergy persons, union leaders, student activists, community leaders. We wanted each worker to know that they were supported. And when you would be accompanied back to your restaurant, to your job, the opportunity for that group then to address other workers, to address management, and to address the restaurant itself always presented itself because, you know, when you have a group coming into a McDonald's or a Burger King or a Wendy's or Hardee's or whatever, you know, you go to the counter, you ask to speak with management, and you know, talk with them directly about what you're there to do. And that's to return a worker, but also to say that you stand with that worker and will be engaged in supporting that worker in the future. And so this was very successful in St. Louis in keeping folks from losing their jobs. Number one, nobody was fired in St. Louis. And then secondly, there were over 20 cases of workers either losing hours or losing pay, or, you know, workers felt like they were being retaliated against for what they had done. Well, then community leaders went right back into those restaurants and negotiated with management, talked about what was going on or asked why this worker was being treated differently. And in every case, you know, the situation was resolved in favor of the worker. So we felt very good about community engagement that was providing some significant support to workers as they continue to go about their organizing, because this is the key to this entire process, is what workers are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So workers have to continue to do what they do. You know, if community members can support them in some way, that's great, that's fine, and that needs to happen. But the key to this is what workers need to do. And they're being exceptionally courageous because they are at will at all times in their job places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the fast food industry, they have no protection. They can literally be dropped at any time. So this is why building a close relationship with community supporters who are consumers in these restaurants is extremely important.
Yeah. Now, in with all, I mean, I think those tactics and the strategies, I mean, it's very interesting when I was reading about it. But I'm also curious, what was management's reaction to this? I mean, you said no one was fired, but have they tried any sort of retaliation or anything like that? Like, what has management's response been to these sorts of campaigns?
Well, of course, they have tried to retaliate in several ways, but again, depending on the level of community support and action, I think most restaurants have a kind of a, at least my experience as a leader, community leader, and as a minister, my experience in these situations is that when you go back into a restaurant, you're not necessarily speaking with a representative of the corporation or even the owner of the franchise. Occasionally, most of the time, you're speaking with a manager or a supervisor when the conversation begins. but that is a good place to start. So if we do not get any good attention from a manager or a supervisor, then we have to step it up. We have to, you know, ask to speak with other persons who can represent authority in that particular restaurant. Most of the time, when there's an issue that arose with a supervisor in most of these restaurants, then the corporate entity pretty much took over and then would come in to send in a regional representative or someone who could smooth the waters, basically. So that is what occurred in most cases, where corporate would then, you know, kind of address the situation, smooth the waters, as it were, take care of a worker. And they did not, you know, corporate does not want a negative publicity piece around this in their restaurants. So the tactic of using and the strategy of making sure that workers had strong accompaniment and community support really was a plus for workers. However, again, I'm just saying that it doesn't mean that workers are still completely vulnerable and unprotected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's, I'm just saying, I mean, certainly community can bring pressure to bear, and that is important and good, and sometimes can win for workers, but the workers are still in a highly vulnerable position. I mean, this is why this work is so challenging.
Right.
Because these are contingent, or the way that corporate wants to look at these jobs is that wants to make them contingent or transient, or, you know, they're so low wage and so, you know, kind of you're kind of removed from your own humanity and dignity that you know, folks don't want to stay in these jobs long. And the ones who do are really dedicated to doing the best possible work. And so when you've got leaders who actually have stayed in fast food for a long period of time, they are folks who have a desire to do a good job and who, you know, want to make this a job that will work for them. But that will only happen when they get better wage and the right to form a union without retaliation. Now, you know, there are 36,000 fast food workers in St. Louis, so this is a fast-growing industry. It's highly successful, very, very profitable. It can afford to pay workers a better wage, and the question is, how do we get there? And the industry should pay a better wage, and we, as, you know, members of this community, should not be subsidizing that wage through government programs. I mean, certainly a person, we will be releasing a report, the Economic Policy Institute report on the Family Budget Calculator, July the 8th in St. Louis and in Missouri, where we just look at what it costs for a family of four to live in our community with kind of minimal health care and child care opportunity. So if you're working full-time in fast food and only making, on average in St. Louis, $11,000 a year, you know, how far short does that fall of meeting the basic necessities of your life? And if it falls drastically short, which it does, then who is paying for the inputs that your family needs to survive? Who is paying for the health care, the housing, the food, etc., the clothing, the social service support that you need just basically to survive? So basically the fast food industry, my understanding is the research indicates that the fast food industry is getting $4 billion in government subsidy just through programs to support their workers. This
Wow.
in relationship to the fact that McDonald's alone made $5.5 billion in profits last year in the United States. Alone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about the rest of the fast food.
Yeah,
industry.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So this is, you know, again, it's a successful industry. We want them to be successful. These are actually good jobs that will remain in our communities. They're not going to China. So we need to make these good jobs. We need to make these jobs that pay a fair wage, to pay a wage that covers the basic necessities of life for workers and provides a level of benefit and support to workers and their families.
In talking about, I mean, you say $7.35 an hour is the minimum wage in Missouri, correct?
That's the minimum wage in Missouri.
Wow.
And that's what a lot of our workers make, or they make slightly more than that.
Yeah.
Occasionally are in the mid sevens, basically,
yeah.
Or sometimes in the upper sevens. But, still far under what is required to meet basic necessities of life, plus the fact that, again, in St. Louis, most workers average, fast food workers average about 24 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, you have no control over your hours. You could be, person can go to work and then they can be told, you know, let's just say it's a slow sales day, you know, and they know this to the minute because their registers are actually noting sales. The registers note labor costs, sales, and everything else. So on a minute-to-minute basis, they kind of know the financial position of the restaurant. So if you're coming in and it's been a slow day, they can say, well, you just need to go home.
Yeah.
Today. All right?
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to, 735, it's interesting because, here in Manitoba, in Canada, our minimum wage is about 10 something an hour.
Sure.
Even there, that's the difference there. I mean, the three something dollars an hour is huge, really, when you get down to it, when someone,
yeah,
you know.
Your minimum wage actually has been essentially, it reflects, just a connection to inflation over the years. I started my job in retail in 1969, my first low wage, minimum wage job. I did it in 1969, it was like $1.35. That was minimum wage. Well, if you were just to take that $1.35 and upgrade it per inflation over the next essentially three decades to this point, or four decades, you're looking at about $10.80 an hour. All right? So our actual minimum wage has been reduced over the last four decades by about 35%.
Wow, yeah.
In the United States. So people are not aware of that. They're just not thinking about this. And they think that the jobs are, these are jobs for kids. That is completely incorrect at this point. You know, the average age of a fast food worker in St. Louis is 28. The average woman in fast food in St. Louis is 32 with a family. Women make up 65% of the fast food workers in St. Louis and across the nation, actually. So these are becoming more and more career jobs, not jobs for adult workers.
And talking about that minimum wage, are you also doing campaigns in Missouri to legislation to raise the minimum wage as well?
Yes, of course. Outside of what workers are doing, their work is very critical because they are addressing what they need to address for themselves. That's raising wages and getting the opportunity to form a union without retaliation. But on top of that, the community itself is working to address the needs of low-wage and low-income people. Number one, we are working very hard on increasing the minimum wage. In fact, the minimum wage would have been increased by initiative campaign, statewide initiative campaign. Would have happened last year if it were not for the fact that our 350,000 signatures for the statewide campaign, it was suppressed. I'm not going to go into a long story about that. Let me just say that we have the votes in Missouri to increase the minimum wage, and that will happen at some point. We brought together both a group of people that were working on the minimum wage, and again, that's Missouri Jobs with Justice. We've been focused on this for many years, and another set of folks who were also interested in capping these payday loans, which are really raking in money and fees from low-wage workers. And so we put those two things together. I think, you know, we got enough signatures to get both on the ballot. We would have won on both because both poll exceptionally highly in our state. But we will push this forward in future years, and we'll be successful in raising the minimum wage. But remember, that's a minimum wage. It's not a wage that really covers the basic living necessities of a family. And that's why we kind of separate this. Yes, we want to raise the minimum wage. We want to get Medicaid expansion. We want to get health care for low-wage workers. We want to address anti-union legislation. There's a lot of stuff that we want to do and have to be done, and we are doing. But that's apart from the work that workers are doing. You know, their job is to get represented and to get their wage to a place where it will support them and their families.
Great. Well, I'll have to end it there, but thank you very much for coming on.
Not a problem.
Canada's far north, above the tree line and south of the ice caps, lies the tundra. Sweeping lowlands and towering mountains form the landscape of this epic ecosystem, and nature thrives here. Tundra wildlife must adapt to winters with endless nights and temperatures as low as minus 50 degrees Celsius. During the summer, flowering plants, mosses, and lichens burst from the soil above the permafrost. Some animals migrate here to have their young, while others have evolved to live here year-round. The tundra is home to a wide array of wildlife, including species at risk, like the barren ground caribou and Porcelled Bryum, a kind of moss. We need to conserve this vast, incredible part of our planet. And that's just a start. To learn more about the tundra, visit hww.ca.
Tune in to Groundswell Radio every Monday afternoon from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. From integral serialism to post-minimalism to improvised electroacoustics and everything beyond and in between, Groundswell Radio opens your ears to the world of new music. Interviews with composers, rarely heard recordings, and so much more. Sit back and listen to something new and different on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
You're tuned to CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We're a campus community radio station located in the University of Winnipeg at 515 Portage Avenue. Our transmitter is located in Osborne Village, broadcasting with 450 watts of power 24/7. The wide variety of music on this radio station won't be played anywhere else. All the programming is done by volunteers from our community. If you want to get in touch with us, give us a call at 786-9782 or email us at ckuw@uwinnipeg.ca.
You're still listening to Warning Shots on CKUW 95.9 FM. Just before that break, you heard Scott Price talking with Martine Raffanen on fast food worker strikes. We now turn to China. In China's most recent five-year economic plan announced in June of last year, nomadic pastoralists in Tibet, Inner Mongolia, and in Xinjiang Autonomous Region are facing forced resettlement by the Chinese government into new homes. Over 1.5 million nomads are to be settled into more than 240,000 new homes. Scott Price talks with journalist Hannibal Rhodes about the plan and its effect on the indigenous populations. Here it is.
Hannibal, could you talk about within this Chinese plan of resettlement of nomads? Let's just first talk about who are the indigenous people who are going to be affected by this. Sort of like, where do they live? What kind of lives do they lead? Kind of to give the listeners a general idea of what the people are like that we're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, it's probably something to point out that though China's voted in favor of the UN Declaration of Indigenous Peoples, it actually doesn't recognize any indigenous peoples within China. So it's accepted the declaration, but it's actually nullified its relevance to China. So it wouldn't consider any of these people to be indigenous. It would consider them to be one of the 55 ethnic minorities that are in the country. But the people we're talking about are really from three regions, from Tibet, which became part of China in 1950, Inner Mongolia, which became part of China in 1947, and the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, which also became part of China in 1950. And the ethnic minorities we're really talking about here are the Uyghurs and Kazakhs from Xinjiang, ethnic Mongols from Inner Mongolia, and ethnic Tibetans from Tibet. And those are all technically ethnic autonomous regions, which means that they have their own administrative government and supposedly the right to practice their own culture. So the people there that are threatened by the 12-5-year plan, which is the forced resettlement of nomads, I think 1.5 million into 240,000 new homes. That's the plan, at least from now, or from last year when the plan was brought in. They're nomadic pastoralists, which means that their main mode of living is animal husbandry, so rearing and keeping herd animals like sheep, goats, cattle, camels. And that's kind of an adaption to the sort of landscape they're living in, which is steppe and grassland, which isn't suitable for subsistence farming. So they tend to live at low population densities, and they use the animals basically to convert the wealth of the landscape into human usable products like meat, blood, milk, skins. So the health of the herd is kind of the group's security. And so, of course, that being the case, access to good pasture and land and water is pretty essential to the health of this way of life. So the people have for thousands of years, in some cases, relied on keeping the grasslands and the ecosystems healthy so that when they're ranging over them to find water and pasture, they need to be able to come back to that another year. So they run rotations. It's quite carefully managed so that the ecosystems don't become degraded and they can be used over and over again. So that's kind of how they make their living. But it's not quite recognized in the same way by the Chinese government.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a massive undertaking, like you said, like 1.5 million people being resettled, and sort of the political parts of it, as these regions are supposed to be autonomous. So what is the Chinese government's justification for this? Because they're saying that they have to solve this nomad problem. So what is with that, and what are their justifications for doing this?
Well, the nomadic problem is kind of, it's both social and environmental, how they framed it. They're quite easy fodder for development jargon in China, because their caste is very backward, anachronistic people, which makes them an easy target, because public perception of them is that, you know, they live miserable, impoverished lives, that sort of any change is good change. So that's, you know, that's the social nomad problem, is this idea that they are stuck in the past and they need modernizing with the rest of the country. And environmentally, their justification for this particular, the resettlement, why they're choosing to do it that way, is that the grasslands in those three regions, which include in Tibet, the Tibetan Plateau, which is a very important grassland region, especially for supplying a lot of other parts of Asia with water, that the grassland is being severely degraded. And the figure that's come out is that 90% of the country's 400 million hectares is being degraded, and the Chinese state placed that blame at the feet of nomads and say, you know, it's overgrazing. Their management strategies are meaning that the grassland's being ruined, basically, and so that's how they've justified it. So by moving the nomads off the grasslands, the Chinese have really set up, or the Chinese government have set up, an argument in which they are not only conserving a vital ecosystem, but also by ending the nomadic way of life, they're inducing the social and economic development of nomadic peoples, increasing sort of their involvement with capital and their access to the state infrastructure, bringing them more in line with other populations in the country.
Yeah, now, what has the reaction been from the indigenous peoples? Because I'm assuming, because this plan was unveiled, I guess, about a year ago, right? And so I'm assuming that this is starting to be put into place. So has there been protests or, well, I guess as much as we can surmise, because I know the Chinese government is very, very tight-lipped on information, but is there any, what has the reaction been from indigenous people? Has there been actions taken, or what is the situation there?
Yeah, there has, and the resettlement's actually been happening for longer. So there have been protests now which have received a decent amount of global attention in some channels, but have been somewhat suppressed in China. There hasn't been all reports from the country, and human rights organizations said that the information has been kept below the radar in the country. But there have been protests in each of the regions, and there's also been ethnic tensions between the Uyghurs and the Han, which is the dominant largest ethnic group in China. I think it's quite clear that the nomads don't want to move, or many of them don't want to move, and they feel like their right to self-determination is being violated. There's been some quite disturbing protests. And in 2011, which was the first year of the five-year plan, so it's from 2011 to 2015, there was numerous incidents of self-immolations, so people burning themselves in the street in Tibet, and it's thought that 18 herders did so out of sheer disgust, I suppose, but also frustration that they were being forced. There's other sort of ways that the nomads have made their voices heard. So there's the Southern Mongolian Human Rights Information Center, which is a human rights watch sort of organization, and the nomads of Imintim, which is a city in or a town in Tibet, released a statement through the center saying, through means of deception and force, the government is literally plundering our land. So there's certainly not a unanimous feeling that they're being settled for their own betterment, and it seems to be definitely in violation of their own wishes in lots of cases.
Now, in talking about these tensions, I mean, there was also recently, I mean, maybe it's hard to tell, but I mean, there's also these clashes that happened in the far west of China, between these ethnic tensions. Do you know if there was any connections there to this settlement plan?
I don't know.
Yeah.
No, but I do know at the moment in China there is a dialogue happening around how the distinctions between ethnic and mainstream are being managed. So there is quite a strong current of people saying that they'd like the distinctions to be broken down, identity cards to be changed, and for ethnic autonomous regions to be opened up. And that's caused a lot of tension, because that's seen by people who are opposed that as a much broader attempt at assimilation to open up and put infrastructure in areas that are the autonomous regions. So I think that that's causing a lot more unrest, and this is just one manifestation of it.
Okay. Now, once these nomadic peoples have been resettled, what has the effect been on them? Is there cases of either poverty or what's happening to them once they settle into these new areas?
Yeah, well, it's a matter of some debate, because there's little information on the actual camps and all the small settlements that they're being moved into, but the effects that's making mobile indigenous people sedentary are quite well known, and it's that you can draw some conclusions from that. They're becoming more involved with state infrastructure. That's the whole aim of the plan. So that means probably getting involved with national, global, more formal economies, and that means probably becoming wage labour and experiencing commoditisation of traditional culture. It means not keeping the same sort of herd numbers, which also means changing social values. And their participation is unlikely to be equitable in economies like that, because they're coming in from a position of not knowing how that world works. And also it involves the breakdown of community to a degree, because not everyone will necessarily be moved to the same place, of the sharing practices. Perhaps a loss in the faith of in autonomous governance, and perhaps even belief systems. That's something which has been seen in assimilated populations all over the world. And so there's a kind of loss of both physical and mental freedom. They're unable to range as they have done. It's a total breakaway from that sort of life, and it's hard to tell what, in the long run, what the consequences of that will be. But also there's we have to be extremely worried about the health of these people, because they whilst in the Chinese the Chinese government's plan and their stated plan is to create prosperous societies out of nomads, we've seen claims of this elsewhere, and people have ended up living in poor environmental conditions, often in slums or roadside camps, and they end up with, you know, sanitation problems, an unfamiliar and often unhealthy diet, exposure to alcohol and other drugs, and also often increased incidence of chronic diseases, so cancer, heart disease, things that they would have experienced in much smaller amounts usually whilst living their traditional lifestyles. So it's not so much a matter of what we know at the moment, more that what we have to be worried about, what the potentials are and what the precedents are from other stories of assimilation.
Right. No, I think that's a good point. But well, Hannibal, I think we'll leave it there. But a lot of great information on this very, interesting issue. And I'm glad that you came on to talk about it, because it's something that's pretty fascinating. But at the same time, you know, not. As far as in Western media, from what I know, not a heck of a lot of coverage. So thank you for coming on.
That's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Yo, I've been shown there's a power and spirit in everything. Can't own, taste, touch, or hear it, but it's everything. Something calls a primal energy to birth shapes. Could be a dream, we still fall when the earth shakes. What I mean is that the one is really two is really three. And the one who weaves the pattern is the one who's really me. And you and the sweet secret music, the blueprint. The one even before the supreme being unit. The sleeper will awaken when the frequency's tuned in. Cause love is the ruler when you zoom out or zoom in. The union of opposites, electromagnetic. Universal love in the code of our genetics. Planetary systems, galaxies, cosmos. Nucleus and electrons, what is the cause though? The light and the substance.
substance like wife and a husband. The wheel keeps spinning, all of life is this love thing.
Love,
L-O-V-E, and that's me.
Love,
L-O-V-E, and that's we.
Love,
L-O-V-E, and that's the entire universe with a single heartbeat. It goes,
love,
L-O-V-E, and that's me.
Love,
L-O-V-E, and that's we.
Love,
L-O-V-E, and that's the entire universe with a single heartbeat.
Some say the L word is all that's needed, but I believe it to be true love undefeated. Let your heart beat, breathe it in and then repeat it. But you can feel it from your feet deep down to the double helix. And it's been there for birth since you were a fetus. You see, the earth is a church, let a sermon heal us. You need to unlearn the hurt that the preachers teach us. Observe the phoenix, free to rise like Jesus. Leave it all beneath the sand, it supersedes life or destiny. But what we manifest is death essentially. A disconnected entity of no identity, no molecular density. Just this undetectable source of secular energy. Perspective is key, but a projection on a screen. Direct a view of the movie, though it won't affect the scene. The brain protects the ego, not the soul, or so it seems. Till it kills the self-esteem and its reflection of a dream.
Love, L-O-V-E, and that's me.
Love,
L-O-V-E, and that's we.
Love,
L-O-V-E, and that's the entire universe with a single heartbeat. It goes,
love,
L-O-V-E, and that's me.
Love,
L-O-V-E, and that's we.
Love,
L-O-V-E, and that's the entire universe with a single heartbeat.
Your heart beats when you sleep. You trust that you breathe what your eyes can't see. Time to ride hands free. Your heart beats when you sleep. You trust that you breathe what your eyes can't see. Time to ride hands free.
The love
that I have for this world is like a father's love for a sweet little girl. The love I receive from the one is like a mother's love for her favorite son. So grateful, so joyous, so full that I might burst apart and destroy us. So good, so evil, so light, so dark, so heathen, so holy, so untamed, so one with the one without a name. So holy, so untamed, so one with the one without a name. Nobody can hold me, no mind can try and control me, no theory try and explain, no synapses fired inside of a brain. Yes, I am, I am. Yes, I am, I be. Everything I see is you, is I, is you, is we. Love.
Well, we're just about done here on Warning Shots. I've been the fill-in for Scott Price, host. John Wilson is me. The last clip we played was Scott Price talking with a journalist, Hannibal Rhodes, about the plan to force resettlement of nomadic pastoralists in Tibet and Inner Mongolia. And they're facing forced resettlement by the Chinese government into new homes. So over 1.5 million nomads are to be settled into more than 240,000 new homes. If you ever want to download an episode of this program or pretty much any program on CKUW, head to our website, ckuw.ca, and go to the program schedule and program guide, and you can download from the archive there. If you're looking for other independent news content produced by CKUW, you can head to ckuwnews.ca. I'm assuming Scott will be back next week, but that is all for today's program. Coming up next is, of course, Mercy of Slumber, but we're just going to play a couple or another track off this Sweatshop Union, their new CD, Infinite, and I just played the song Love, and now I'm going to finish off the program with another song of theirs called Family Reunion. You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Soul of the continent, rebirth of common sense, redirect energy, we reflect God within. Most of y'all forgotten them, trust me, this is not the end. I was promised victory, before it's done I got to win. Mama, I'ma take it back, reconcile the sky and earth. They done disrespected you so long, brought down the curse. Drought, famine, earthquakes,
disease. Tsunamis and they still calling you make-believe. Oh, they gon' see if it's the last thing they do, but they still digging, shoveling and blasting at you. Time for intervention, we're severely addicted. Need a family reunion each year till we fix it. Mother, father, son, daughter, earth, wind, fire, water. I am part of the all, chaos and divine order. Never been real, to bring it on if you ask us. Get your hands up, we living long in this past. Oh my goddesses, bitches, gentlemen, thugs. To all my people around the world, sending my love. Never been real, to bring it on if you ask us. Get your hands up, we living long in this past. Monsters, doctors, defenders of life. To all my people, represent the army of life. Never been real, to bring it on if you ask us. Get your hands up, we living long in this past. Yeah.
Floating through consciousness, picking up a trade wind to help guide prominence. She birthed the populace and we built the metropolis. Till the city sleeps, bad dreams and broken promises. Sifting through these documents, I find the consequences heavy. Let me exchange thoughts for a penny, or for 99 of them. We the 99%, we divine kind. Our minds will conquer all of them, yeah. Let the black goddess slaughter all of them, yeah. Remove ego, remain regal. Lose the hierarchy, my kings and queens are all equal. Reaching heaven on earth, eternal people to my mother, father, son, daughter, earth, wind, fire, water. I am part of the all, chaos in divine order. Never been real, to bring it on if you ask us. Get your hands up, we living long in this bastard. Oh my goddesses, bitches, gentlemen, thugs. To all my people around the world, sending my love. Never been real, to bring it on if you ask us. Your hands up, we living long in this bastard. Monsters, doctors, defenders of life. To all my people, represent the army of life. Never been real, to bring it on if you ask us. Get your hands up, we living long in this bastard. Yeah. Let the sunlight burn the gray, black and white turn to beige. Spinal tap the nerve away. Far from afraid of their race, taxes or the murder rates. It may hurt the working class, but we are here eternally. Free how we prefer to live, each day in search of it. Needed like dreams from the pineal, me nourishment. Feed your soul, no GMOs, cheeseburger, preservative. Fuck them greedy CFOs or socialist conservatives. We cannot whose word it is, they cannot whose world is this. Why we get high just to fly through the turbulence. Feels good to be alive and deserving it. So ride till we die, or it's time to return to earth, wind, fire, water, mother, father, son, daughter. We are all one. Nothing but love conquers. Never been real. I bring it on if you ask us. Get your hands up. We're living long in this past. Oh my goddesses, bitches, gentlemen, thugs. To all my people around the world, sending my love. Never been real. I bring it on if you ask us. Get your hands up. We're living long in this past. Monsters, doctors, defenders of life. To all my people, represent the army of life. Never been real, to bring it on if you ask us. Get your hands up, we living long in this bastard. Yeah.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM Radio.
If you need a taxi, just call Pound Taxi on your cell phone. That's Pound 8294 and get connected to the first available taxi or the cab company you want. You'll never get a busy signal 24 hours a day anywhere in Canada. Getting a taxi has never been easier, so plan ahead. Don't drink and drive and choose to use Pound Taxi by pressing Pound 8294 on your cell phone. This Pound Taxi message is in association with MAD Canada.
Friday afternoons on CKUW are brought to you by Half Pints Brewing Company, Winnipeg's only local brewery.
Yeah!